Hi, I'm Bill Roller of Beacon Rock Wealth Advisors, and I'm here with Michael Harding of Keller Williams, and today we're going to talk about real estate. Michael, tell me about how you got started in real estate and Keller Williams and how you got here and what happened before.
Yeah, well, thank you, Bill. Again, my name is Michael Harding. I'm with Keller Williams, Premier Partners here in Vancouver, Washington, and how I got into real estate. In 2003, my wife and I, we bought our current house, and I thought it was a fascinating process. And then fast forward 5 years, you know, the whole market crashed because of the Great Recession, and so they were talking about how real estate was a great investment at the time, and
could only go up and never go down, and you know,
right.
buy real estate and be diversified and. When the global financial crisis hit, it was driven by real estate.
Right, and everyone needs a place to live. Everyone needs a place to live to rest their head at night. And so we talked about getting into real estate as investors, and so we tried that, but we couldn't find anyone that was willing to work with us. And so I just turned to my wife one night and said, well, why don't we just skip it and I'll become a realtor. And in 2012, I became a licensed realtor. But at the time, I still had a son that I was providing support for. And so I didn't want to be that dad that, you know, chasing the dollar. And I'd rather provide for my kids. And so I held off on becoming a full-time realtor until my son was of age, and I no longer had to provide financial support for him, because that was important to me to provide support for him. So I tell that to kind of give an indication of, you know, I try to do the right thing, even in business. I'm sure you're the same way. You could probably make a suggestion that in the short term would be ideal, but in the long term, not so much.
Well, that's right, but you have to understand that the time horizon of any client, or really of yourself, what you want to accomplish.
And so, essentially, the short of it is, I 2017, I became a full-time real estate agent. I was with Century 21 at the time, made the switch because they went from a franchise to an independent office, and I just wanted to be part of a franchise because it seemed to have more support, more trainings, more infrastructure and terms like that. So that's when I joined Keller Williams at that time.
So Michael, nobody is born a realtor. At least very few people come out of their mother and immediately start selling real estate. So what did you do before you became a realtor?
Well, when I was 19, I enlisted in the United States Army. And my MOS, military occupational specialty, was 98 Juliet, electronic intelligence, non-communication warfare, electronic intelligence analyst, interpreter analyst. And so what that means is I study radars, and because every radar has a different property, different electronic property, in order to function. And so we studied those and assigned the different units, or determined the unit that it was with, and the function of the unit. So that was pretty good. I did that at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. Then I had orders for Germany. I was supposed to go to Wiesbaden, Germany.
I know Wiesbaden.
Bill, I can tell you how excited I was to go to Wiesbaden. But then on August 2nd, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And so September 1st, landed in the country of Saudi Arabia as a member of the coalition to remove Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi army from Kuwait. And along the way, I caught what is commonly known as the Gulf War Syndrome. And so I'm a disabled veteran, but you know, I'll explain how that impacts me a little later. But then after Saudi, I went back to New Jersey, then went to Sinop, Turkey, which is on the Black Sea, across from the former Soviet Union equivalent to NASA. And so the Mir, the space station, Mir space station?
Yes.
It would go by every 90 minutes or 92 minutes or something like that, and do what we call a data dump, download the intelligence that it gathered on the last mission, and so we would intercept it. So that was pretty cool. And so then after that, I went to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, home of the Buffalo Soldiers, and helped develop Wi-Fi, current day, modern day Wi-Fi. That's what I did, and that was a lot of fun. A lot of time in a desert.
So what brought you here to Vancouver, Washington?
Well, I was born and raised in Portland, and while I was in Saudi Arabia, my dad was in Portland dying of cancer. And so I would call every now and again from Saudi Arabia to check on him. In my last conversation with him, he asked me to get out and take care of my mom. And so I did that until she passed away in January of 2013. But prior to that, I was reunited with my wife, my current wife, and because we went to high school together. And we lost track for 20 years, and we lost track for 17 years. Then we were, through a mutual friend, we were given the contact information, so.
Reintroduced,
yes. That's the word I was looking for. Reintroduced, yes. So, after 6 months of talking to each other on the telephone, we decided to take our kids to a movie. We went and saw AI.
Good movie.
Yeah, we went and saw that. And then, you know, a few months later, we went out on a social date. And you know, I thought she was the best thing that I ever had, and I still feel that way, even stronger. I asked her to marry me, and luckily she said yes.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so, but then...
You're a lucky man.
Yeah, I am. But my wife, at the time, she was going to school, WSU Vancouver, to become a teacher. And then in 2003, I was a... In 1994, I got out of the Army. 1995, I was hired as a letter carrier in Portland. But because of the Gulf War illness that I suffered in Saudi Arabia, I couldn't do that job. It was just physically wrecking my body.
Were you a carrier?
I was a carrier.
Okay.
And I had a walking route, you know, not one of those driving routes. And I'm not saying anything against carriers, what we call a mounted route. You know, I just rather get out and walk and stretch my legs, and because it's easier to stop and talk with people,
right?
When you're at their door versus at their mailbox,
and you're seeing their buildings, and it's probably when you develop the love of real estate.
Yeah, it really is. It really is, because you know, and you notice different real estate properties as you're going. You know, because when I was in Portland, I would do the Piedmont area, which is around MLK and Killingsworth. You know, it goes from 42nd to Williams, and then Mason to the Columbia River. That's the area that it had. But then you go to Southwest Portland, and the real estate is a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
Much bigger houses, newer houses, but you know, bigger yards, and just the dynamics of it. And then I was also at the Selwood station, and that environment was different too, because you know, just the different eras in which the houses were built. And the same thing out in Lentz, the Lentz area of Portland. So, you know, so
were you living in Vancouver and commuting to Portland?
No, I was living in Portland.
Okay.
When I was hired, but then when I proposed to my wife, I moved over here to Vancouver. And you know, just one day I woke up and I turned to my wife and said, "I don't want to do this anymore," because my wife would have to pick me up out of bed, so I could sit up, and everything would hurt. So I went to school and got a degree in accounting. I have a degree in accounting from Clark College, and so then the short of it is, my wife's a teacher at this time, And I was thinking, well, how cool would it be if I worked for the school district and had the same schedule as you? And so she told me about a position that was available at the school that she was at, Jason Lee Middle School. And so I applied for the job as a paraeducator, and I got hired, and I was with the school district for 14 years, 13 years, something like that. So, and I did, and that was the most rewarding job. It really was, because you get to have a true impact in the lives of others, because you could take a troubled child, you know, figuratively and literally put your arm around them and tell them how much you care for them, and it'll eventually sink in, you know. And so that's pretty cool. And so Vancouver is growing, but it's still not that big. Let's be honest, we're not Los Angeles.
Right.
We're not New York.
Thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully. And so I see them. I see the students, my former students, and my kids, as I call them. And, you know, they tell me thank you. You know, they're adults now, and some of them have kids. And you know, it's been, you know, a couple times when I nearly teared up.
Oh,
because
okay.
they pointed, they grabbed their kid, their child, and they say, this is the man that helped save me. You know, and so, back then we had a problem with gangs, and a lot of Hispanic and Ukrainian gangs, and you know, I love them all regardless of where they come from. And so I would look them in the eye and tell them that I love them as a person. And, you know, I used to tell them, I love you like I love my kids. And they, yeah, right. And I said, well, as a dad, if there was somebody, a bad guy trying to come in the house, I would put myself between my kids and the bad guy so that my kids can get away. I said, no, what makes you think I would do anything different right now if somebody tried to come in and harm one of you? I'd get between you and the bad guy so you guys can escape out the back door.
That's right.
So I do the same thing for you as I would do for my own kids. So.
But sometimes dads also have to teach and punish.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I did have a heavy hand, and but it was always out of love. Love for the kids. And so that's what I always told them.
So Michael, it sounds like between the Army, and I was in the Army too, so you know.
Well, thank you for your service.
Good, thank you for your service. Your accounting, you know, so you've had a little bit of a finance background there, finance education, and your time as a teacher, you know, could really set you up real well for your career in real estate, you know, because you know how to, you know, have a pretty good idea of how the money flows, you know how to take care of people, like with your students and your clients, and you're willing to go the extra mile if you were in the Army because you're willing to do it 24/7, right? So kind of talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's really when you look at it in its simplest form, it's about understanding people. You know, in the Army, you know, we get assigned to a commander or a squad leader or somebody, a platoon sergeant, that we really didn't get along with, but we had to adapt and you know, figure it out how to get along. And real estate is the same way in a sense, because you don't, especially as you begin, you don't always get to pick your clients. If you get a referral to go work with this buyer, you know, and you're brand new, then sometimes you don't get the cream of the crop.
No matter, well, you'll always get the cream of the crop, but you may not be able to find that cream sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
I know working in finance, you know, just not everyone is a perfect fit. Not
right.
Because people are bad or anything, but sometimes they just have a different way of looking at the world. And,
yeah.
You know, you may not be able to connect with them on all levels, and you know, but you can still depart as friends.
Right. And you know, being that I had, you know, squad leaders and platoon sergeants and section chiefs that I didn't necessarily like their style, I had to learn to figure it out. And it's the same way, you know, because sometimes there are difficult clients, you know, or difficult situations that clients are in, like a divorce.
Yes.
Like a death. Like a, you know, just there's many, many situations that we can come up with in which there's a lot of tension, a lot of emotions.
Well, any purchase or sale of a giant asset like a house,
right.
I mean, in some ways, that is the most stressful thing that a couple or a person can go through.
Yeah.
And if you combine that with a divorce, I mean, the level of stress for people is just astronomical. Or, you know, death of a parent, or you're selling their house.
Right.
So it all gets kind of stacked up there.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I think I'm really situated to handle, because again, the diversity of the people that I had to work with in terms of being led and being a leader, because being led while in the Army and being a leader in a classroom helped me kind of get used to working with different people from different backgrounds, different belief systems, and different economic and social situations. So I just feel like it's been a blessing.
Yeah.
And it's really, really something that I think has geared me to excel in the human relationship aspect of real estate, because real estate is really less about the numbers and more about the people. Because if you think about it, you got to think about the here and the now, but also the future. So if you help a young 20-something couple purchase a home, well, what's the possibility of you growing your family and now and 5 years from now? So let's center our search around where you're at right now and where you hope to be in 5 years from now. But that's different than working with someone who's 70, for example.
Yes.
Their needs are going to be totally different into the future. So you have to be adjustable, adaptable, and be willing to stick with it and overcome several obstacles that are in the way in this field of real estate.
So, Michael, do you do residential and commercial, or what's the difference there, or kind of what's your specialty?
Well, my specialty is more single family residence, one house, one family. But in real estate, you can have a duplex, which is two separate dwellings, or a triplex, three separate dwellings, or what we consider a quadplex or quad, which is four separate dwellings. And so it's like a duplex, duplex and above is multifamily. Five dwellings and above is considered commercial real estate. And I don't do commercial real estate. Well, that's just one aspect of commercial real estate, I should say. And I just concentrate on the residential portion of it. So anything from one single, house to up to four dwellings is what I do.
So within the residential real estate realm, do you have a specialty or an area that you focus on?
Well,
you've got some designations also, you mentioned.
Yeah, I have the designation Senior Real Estate Specialist, and that one is working with the older, as it would imply, working with those in the senior community, because working with someone that's, from the Great Depression era is different than working for a senior of the Vietnam era, because unfortunately there's not so many from the Great Depression era anymore.
Yeah.
But they grew up under horrific financial duress, and so they were a lot more frugal in their spending habits, and so it would be more difficult to try to get them to, not necessarily go beyond their financial means, but just show them the value of owning a particular piece of property now and in the future because of appreciation. Whereas a Vietnam era senior is more independent thinking, more, not hostile, but just more
numbers driven
and just more likely to be willing to work with you and see the value, you know, based on the numbers of something that could be a good investment for them in the long run. So it's just a mindset of people growing as, you know, as they go through the life stages that they had to undergo that makes it a challenge in certain ways to complete a transaction. But I also have the designation, and I apologize, Certified Distressed Property Expert. And there, you know, there's many, many reasons why people default on a mortgage.
So is that, you handle short sales, is that?
Short sales.
Explain what a short sale is.
A short sale, in a sense, is where you buy a property for, let's say, $300,000. And you make a payment, and then the market collapses, and then it's worth $200,000. Or you make adjustments to the property that causes depreciation, or, you know, what would that be? I don't know. When it doesn't appreciate it, it kind of loses value.
Yeah, it just depreciate, or, you know, mark to market, you know,
right,
down market. It can. We certainly saw that in 2008.
Right. And so, well, that would be a perfect example of you know, market conditions, because houses, the average value of a house in 2007 was $305,500, but in 2008, $278,300.
So if I lost my job or was going to be relocated by my company and I had to get out of a house, what were the options? Take a bath?
Yeah.
Pay off the loan with money I didn't have? Or?
Right. And so the market went down on its own. In 2009, the average price was $237,800. And so if you bought in 2007 at $305,000, but you had to sell at $237,000, you had a negative equity position. And that's essentially what it is. It's just selling at a negative equity position for whatever reason. You know, there's a myriad of reasons why properties lose value. But on those particular instances, it was market-driven that causes the depreciation of the homes. And so when that happens, if you have to sell, or maybe it's an estate that has to sell, maybe mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, somebody passed away and they have to sell.
Well, it could be a builder who has to sell,
right,
or a development company that had
right
to sell.
So in that instance, then the property would be worth less than what is owed on it, or maybe there's a second mortgage on a property and there was a death or you know, something, so it has to be sold for less than the value of the equity position, so the equity comes up short, you know, and so that's where the term short sale comes up.
So Michael, tell us about the current state of the market.
Well,
here in Vancouver, and well, the Portland metro area. For
well, I'm only licensed in Washington, and I only deal in Clark County. So I'll answer the question, but I'll put my primary focus on the Clark County market. The Portland market is crazy. I saw something the other day that it is the 12th fastest growing market in the country.
Which is amazing given all the turmoil in downtown
right
Portland.
Right, yeah exactly.
Still a great place to live and work. But.
Well, it really is, and I love Portland, I really do. But specifically to Vancouver and Clark County, because Clark County really isn't that big, unless you have to walk from one end to the other, but in terms of the commute, it's really not that big. And so I tend to take a look at the greater, broader perspective of Clark County, because I know people that live up in Yacolt, which is in northern Clark
yeah
County, but they work in Hillsborough, so they don't mind that commute. They just put on an Audible book,
yeah,
and then away they go, you know, but it's just a lifestyle that they want. So, but Vancouver has an extreme shortage of inventory. Historically, this time of year, well, as of late, we've been around 2 to 3 months of inventory. And what that means is that, like, say if it's 3.8 months of inventory, well, if nothing came on the market, then in 3.8 months, we would exhaust all the inventory. Well, in January of this year, 2021, we're at 0.8 months of inventory.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's here today, gone today. A lot of multiple bid search, multiple offer search situations. And the days on market, you know, from the time that it's listed, that it goes live, to the time that there's a change in ownership, it's the time that there's a mutual acceptance, a mutual agreement on the property. At the height of the crash that we were referring to earlier,
you mean 2008.
Well, in 2008, the days on the time on market, the days on market was 150 days.
Wow.
In January is 36 days.
What's driving this shortage of inventory?
Well, I think it's the growth of the people moving to Vancouver, possibly from Portland, because of the unrest. Some people, and the valuation of the homes in Portland is substantially higher than here in Vancouver. Because Tiger, you know, Tualatin, you know, Westland, Happy Valley, all those areas, they're going up so quickly in value that the wages and the earnings of the families can't keep up, and so they look for a more economical area that they can afford.
Is that working people, or is that retirees, or both?
It's a little bit of both, especially with the retirees, because most retirees are on a fixed income. So they can't handle a large increase in a large fluctuation in their monthly expenses. And so they look for a place that's more economical, and more economical agreement with their funds. And so they move to Vancouver, Clark County.
Come for the home values, stay for the low taxes.
Yep, exactly. And that's precisely what happens. But we have very little inventory, and that's driving up the prices, and it's causing bidding wars, you know, because I just listed a house for $450,000, 10 days at the most.
Wow.
I had an offer, you know, for $450,000. But there was another time when I sold a house recently, we had it on the market for $312,000, and it sold for $320,000.
So you're seeing offers coming in above the asking price.
Right. As a whole, the market is 101.6% above the ask price. And what I mean by that is, let's use that $312,000 listing. We put it on the market for $312,000. We got it for $320,000. It was sold for $320,000. So whatever the percentage is above that, you know. So that's what I mean.
Have you had any recent ones done below the initial asking price?
Well, some people, they try to maximize the value of their home by listing it way above.
So they go super high.
And so, you know, sometimes those prices have to come down. Because not only do you have to find a buyer, it has to appraise at that agreed upon amount too.
Yeah.
So, because the banks are heavily invested in this, because, I mean, let's be honest, the bank actually, or the mortgager, actually owns the property. You're just paying on it until...
You're renting until it's paid off.
Exactly. And so they have a vested interest in making sure that it's of the value that you're qualified to purchase it for. So it has to appraise, and it has to be something that they feel confident will maintain its value. So it's not just, you know, finding a buyer that's willing to pay the price. It also, if they have a mortgage, a loan with the company, it also has to appraise at that amount as well.
So, Michael, we tend to think of Clark County as being kind of this monolithic market, but, you know, I'm sure there are hot areas and even hotter areas within Clark County. So
yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, Bill, and I'm of the opinion that there's no bad areas here in Clark County. There really is, I mean, in terms of livability. Some areas are more desirable but there's no real bad areas. And so with that said, like Clark County, that's like Battleground is a good area. Hawkinson, Brush Prairie, Salmon Creek, Philida, the Heights, you know, and
Camas.
Camas, Washougal. I mean, they're their own little pockets of you know, real estate or communities that are separate from, you know, Clark County as a whole in terms of the livability, because again, I don't believe there's any bad areas, but I just think that some are just more desirable than others. And it depends on where you are, what stage in life that you're in as well, because if you're a young couple looking for a solid school district, then I would point you towards Camas, because Camas traditionally has the school district usually ranks really, really high in the school districts. But if you're looking for something with a high walkability score, then I would point you downtown Vancouver.
Well, yeah, my mom, when she was in her 70s and 80s, lived near the hospital,
yeah,
which was very convenient.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, that just goes to where they're at in that point in time in their life and where they plan to be 5, 10, 15 years from now. And trying to find the right location to suit their needs. But in terms of the monolithic approach, it's different, even in the communities itself, because some parts of Philida, our Fisher's Landing, for example.
Yes.
They kind of border the Camas area, but Fisher's Landing is different than Camas.
Yes.
But they're so close to one another, it's kind of like Portland and Vancouver. Well, Vancouver's not Portland, and Portland's not Vancouver. Fisher's Landing is not Camas, and Camas is not Fisher's Landing, but they're so close to one another that they're synonymous with one another in a sense.
The demographics kind
right.
of overlap.
Right, so. They kind of bleed in together, yeah. You know, it's kind of like a property line that's determined by a blade of grass. You know, like, well, no, that's your blade of grass to mow, not mine. But they're so close together that, you know, it's just one and the same. But, yeah, Clark County is just a beautiful area to live and work in. And we have it really, really, really good. And I was thinking about this the other day because we live close enough to Portland, which is a major city. Yeah, it's not as big as some others, but it's still a major city. If you wanna go eat a fine meal, you're like a Michelin star star restaurant, you can go to Portland.
But you don't have to pay to live there.
Right, exactly. If you wanna travel internationally, Portland. If you wanna go see the arts, they have a beautiful art museum, they have a world-class zoo. You know, there's so many things that's beautiful about living here in Vancouver, because of its proximity to Portland, and it's just a great place to be, because it's close, but it's different and it's separate, and it's just a place that's like no other. One of the best things that I think about this area, and you know, being in the Army, you traveled all over the country, all over the world.
Yes.
When I was in the Army, I always missed home, you know, the Portland area, because every time that when I was a kid, I would wake up and look at Mount St. Helens pre-eruption. On the way to school, we would take the bridge over 33rd, going to Whitaker School in Columbia when it was on Columbia. And I would look at Mount St. Helens and all her beauty. And then I'd look over to the east and see Mount Hood, and look to the west and watch the sunset, knowing that it's going down over the ocean. It's such a diverse area in terms of the climate. And, you know, I'm saying that as we're driving through, knowing that there's a rainforest, you know, not that far. So it's just a beautiful area to live in. And I'm sorry, that wasn't exactly what you were looking for in terms of an answer, but I just love being here.
Everybody loves the different geography all over the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, because we have the coast.
Yes. We have the mountains.
We have the mountains, and then we have the coastal range, which is different than the range like Mount St. Helens, Mount Adams, Mount Hood, Mount Jefferson, the Three Sisters, and such, Mount Bachelor. So it's just a beautiful, beautiful, diverse place. And then we have the forest and the rainforest. Then you go out east and we have the high plateaus and the high desert. And so I just love this region. But anyways, I digress.
Never boring.
Never boring. But yeah, it's great to live here in Clark County. Clark County is a beautiful, beautiful place. The more desirable areas, it depends on where you are and what you want. If you're an investor, I would point you one direction. But if you're looking for a long-term, you know, place to plant your roots, I'd point you in a different direction. And it all depends on your qualifications, you know, your credit history, your income, and, you know, all those things. So there's quite a bit that actually goes into determining what's a perfect fit for someone. And I helped a young couple not that long ago find their first home. They bought their first home, and I was so happy for them.
And where did they buy?
They bought over, you know, where Cascadia Skill
yes.
Center?
Yes.
Yeah, they bought in that general area.
Nice area.
Yeah, it's a great area.
Walking distance to Lowe's.
Yeah, exactly. And so so they bought in that area, and they couldn't quite find a place that they would want to plant their roots. And so then it's like, well, is this going to be your forever home? And they were like, no, we plan on moving in, you know, 5-10 years or so. And let's broaden our search a little bit.
Yeah, especially with short inventory or
lack of
exactly. inventory.
Yeah, and they were outbid. We had to write 7 offers before we had one accepted.
Wow.
Yeah. And that house that I mentioned earlier, that was $320,000, that was sold for, that was their 12th offer that they had written before it was accepted. So
wow.
It's a low inventory, high demand. You know, you better come completely prepared, or else you're gonna miss out. And that's unfortunate, because there's a lot of families out there that's in need of a place to stay. They want to do the right thing and provide a nice environment for the family to grow.
Don't want to pay a 6-month lease for an apartment.
Right. And you know, the tax advantages of owning a home.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially if you work out of your home, like a lot of people are doing now. It's just a lot of benefit to owning a home, and I'm happy to be part of that process.
So Michael, obviously, you know, it's 2021 and COVID is still an issue. So how is COVID affecting inventory or both inventory and the homes that you're seeing?
Well, it's changed the way that realtors can do business, because it used to be where we would get a listing and we'd have an open house and invite the public to come look at the house. While we're in phase one, there's no open houses. And then phase two, there's open houses with restrictions, because you can't just have a bunch of people in at once. So it really alters the way that we do business. But
how many people can show up at an open house now in phase two?
One family.
One family at a time.
Yeah.
One household at a time.
One household, yes, one household.
Wow.
Yeah.
Kind of drags out
the open home process. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I've held open houses in various parts of the community in which I've had 3 families in at once, 3 separate households, but not lately.
Not lately. So there have been kind of some technological things, because you hear of like Matterport and you know, virtual reality
right.
kinds of setups, so people can look at homes remotely or on the web.
Right, yeah. And what a lot of realtors do is they grab their cell phone and they go like Facebook, or they
FaceTime?
FaceTime, yeah.
Okay.
And they walk through and, you know, they kind of just, you know, okay, well this is the master bedroom and this is the master bath, and okay, you have a big walk-in closet here, and you know, oh look, there's a nice high ceiling, and it looks to be about 12 feet, and you know, so it just, again, it just changes the way that we do it.
Which is good in a lot of ways, you know, the market's adapting
right.
to it, using the available tools. And
right, well, it used to be where, you know, we had to, if we wanted to get from point A to point B, we had to get the old horse strapped up, and now we just
that's right.
jump in the car and turn the key. Well, some of them, we don't even need to turn the key. We just push on the brake and hit power, and then the vehicle starts up, and away we go, or the electronic vehicles. And so, yeah, technology continues to evolve.
How many Zoom meetings have we all been at in the last year? You know, doing the Brady Bunch.
Yeah. Was my eye roll evident enough? I was like, oh my gosh, not another one. But back to your question about COVID, I think COVID is having a huge impact on the market because prior to COVID, we had two separate lives at two separate locations. We had our home life and we had our work life. But because of COVID, there's no more gathering at a huge, huge office, you know, downtown, wherever, or a large commercial building. It's more people are working from home.
Yeah, I saw one figure that occupancy of big, giant red box buildings in New York City is down to 20%.
Yeah.
In those buildings.
Yeah.
Which seems rather high.
Right.
Yeah, and certainly with, you know, in Portland, a lot of the major guys are pulling out of the downtown area.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's huge amounts of space there because everybody's working from home.
Yeah. Did you know that the Twin Towers back in New York had their own zip code?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going back to my postal days.
Yes.
But, the Twin Towers, could you imagine, well, and even a Freedom Tower or whatever the new building is called. Imagine that at 20%.
A lot of empty offices.
Yeah. And so...
So are you seeing more demand for homes that could have home offices?
Or yes.
I'm almost thinking like, you know, back in a small English village, you know, the doctor had a separate entrance into his office where he would meet with patients that was directly tied onto it. Are you seeing that kind of thing or just larger offices?
Well, larger homes with a room that can be converted, like a bonus room that can be converted to an office. That can be closed off and, you know, kid-proofed in a sense that the kids know that mom or dad is working, so not to disturb them. But yeah, that's a real current trend. And so, but with COVID, what COVID's done is it causes, to me, it's part of the reason why there's a lack of inventory. Because again, you had a separate life, home and work, but then when COVID hit, work and home and school and, you know, everything else became one location.
Gym.
Yeah, the gym. And so people, you know, owners, they are reluctant to disrupt that whole dynamic to move. And so there's not a perfect time to move. And with the shortage of inventory, a lot of people, if they're like a seller, they ask for 4 weeks rent back.
Wow.
So they can find something to move to. And again, if you're in a multiple bid situation, that may take longer than 4 weeks because a typical close takes 30 to 45 days. And so imagine if you're putting in multiple offers on multiple properties because you're always being outbidded. That could be problematic in the sense that, you know, where you're going to go at the end of that rent back period and the new owner takes possession.
Well, it's kind of interesting because you're saying, I hadn't really thought about it that way, that, you know, when you ask somebody to move, you're asking to move their home, their office, their gym, their school. I guess if you throw a mother-in-law,
right?
A parent living into that mix also, it's, you know, the switching cost is extremely high.
Yeah.
So you better make a dynamite offer.
Right. And so
to make it worth their while.
Yeah, that's another trend, is multi-generational living.
You have returning kids from college who aren't going back. You have parents, you know, who maybe had visiting angels coming help them before, and now they don't want to do that anymore.
Right. Or just deteriorating health, in which mom or dad are now older, and so their adult kids, or, you know, son or daughter, and their family, you know, their kids move in to help take care of the aging parents. And so it's just the world of real estate is changing constantly.
Well, it's starting to look like the old sitcom Dallas,
which
you have, you know, three or four generations living under the same roof.
Right, and yeah, I think the largest disparity in terms of generation was five generations living under one roof.
Wow.
Here in Vancouver.
Really? And when was that?
That was within 2 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Five generations.
at Jim Reese.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it was a small family. It was grandma, mom, who was widowed, adult kids, and then their adult kids, and, you know, and then so it was like...
Babies.
Yeah. And they made it work, and they were, you know, on the surface, to me, they were a great family. A lot of love in that house, though.
I bet.
A lot of love. But, yeah, COVID is really, really causing creative thinking, creative problem solving, and just a lot of nuances that hadn't been thought of yet. Because, you know, again, with the cell phone, you know, and the FaceTime, who would have thought of that? I just use it to make goofy faces with my grandkids. You know, you put the little, like the little ones where
right.
you open your mouth and you turn into a dragon.
Instagram. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Right, yeah. Right. And so, but yeah, now we use that as part of our business strategy. So that's one thing that COVID has done for the industry.
So, Michael, you mentioned there's another way that COVID's impacted the local real estate market.
Yeah, when COVID first hit and we had virtually a complete shutdown of businesses, there was a lot of mortgage holders, you know, mortgagees, that couldn't work because the government told them to stay home. And so that impacted their ability to pay the mortgage. And so they made arrangements, a lot of people made arrangements with their mortgage company to not pay while they were under those orders not to work. And so what that did is it created a market known in the industry as forbearance. And what that means is that you made an arrangement with the mortgage company to pay some or make a portion of a partial payment or no payment. And at the time,
because, but of course, interest is still accruing
right.
on all that.
And so it's just
is this kind of like the flip side of the eviction moratorium,
right?
For the rental side,
right?
Okay,
right, where you don't have to make a payment for a certain amount of time until you can get employed again, because imagine food service workers, for example.
Yes,
they've been heavily impacted by COVID, and so they were told to. That they weren't allowed to go to work. So if they don't work, they don't have the income. No income, no paying the mortgage. And it's not through any fault of their own, so that the mortgage companies are more than likely willing to work with them, because it's not just an exclusive to that one household. It's a whole, you know, community worth of problems that they have. So what they do is they just allow you to make a partial payment, you know, or no payment at all. But there's going to come a point in time when they have to resume that agreement.
There is no free money. You know,
there is no free money. There's no free lunches.
Even if it comes from the government, it's not right. necessarily free. So.
Right. And so when they call those due, I think that's when we're going to have a complete reversal of the market. Because right now we have a low inventory.
You think people will sell because they have to?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and it won't be necessarily a short sell, because the valuation of the homes hasn't decreased. It hasn't diminished at all. The valuation of the homes has just steadily gone up.
Right. Well, the value of the home's gone up, but the value, but the size of somebody's bank account has gone down.
Right.
So they may just say, hey, I might as well sell it and,
right.
and basically roll down
right.
either rent or find something cheaper. You know, sell this inflated asset, you know, dig out of the hole that they're in, you know, even with forbearance.
Right, and so I think that's what's gonna cause us a switch in the market, because right now we're just deeply buried into a seller's market.
Well, I've heard some realtors say that there's really a shortage of entry level homes.
Yes.
Okay. So, but you're talking about kind of the mid range people where they have the capacity. And then they're going to roll down to entry level. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, yes, yes, and no, but more on the yes side, because even the people that are at the entry level, they're in some state of forbearance as well.
So entry level is going to go to the apartments.
Right.
Mid-range is going to go down to entry level.
And then the
super expensive homes
going to go down to the mid-level, if you will.
Yeah.
So.
And then the high-level of homes, people moving from California.
Right. And they have cash.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people are moving from the Bay Area. And the San Francisco area has the most expensive real estate market in the country.
Still working for Facebook or still working for Google doing it remotely.
Right, exactly. And so they're able to sell at a high price and come to Portland or Vancouver and be like, whoa, look at this.
Yeah.
Yeah, this would be, you know, a million and a half where I'm from.
In beautiful Palo Alto, which is, you know, three bedrooms, two baths.
Yeah, I have a friend that his mom lived in San Francisco. I don't remember the community in San Francisco, you know, the neighborhood, but it was a three-bedroom, two-bath house overlooking the bay. And 3 years ago, it sold for $900,000.
Yeah.
And it was less than 1,000 square feet.
Well, and if you think about it, though, I mean, you got to have people who are willing to buy those homes.
Right.
Down the Bay Area, so you could almost see a race for the exits,
yeah,
to get out first and move up here. So.
Right, and you know, according to some in the industry, that's exactly what's been going on, and that's what one reason why there's been such an increase in the valuation of homes here locally, and by locally, I mean the Portland, Vancouver, Hillsboro area,
yeah.
Because that's the Portland metropolitan area is considered Portland, Vancouver, Hillsboro. So anything within that range is considered part of the Portland metro area. But yeah, I think that once the notes are called due or the payments are called due for those that's in some stage of forbearance, I think there's going to be a flood of homes being placed on the market, and that's going to drive down the valuation of homes. So and to me, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It really isn't.
Normalizes supply and demand.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So I think I'm of the opinion that a reset isn't necessarily a bad thing because it allows more people to get into the homes and the joy of home ownership. So I think that as long as it's not an extended reset, you know, like just a quarter or two, I think those are not necessarily a bad thing.
So, Michael, you brought some numbers with you. What do you got?
I did. Well, I brought a data sheet that gives the number of listings, pendings, the close, average sales price, median sales price, and the total market time. And I began at the year 2000, Y2K, remember that.
Made an impression in the financial markets, yes.
Yeah, so... We went from there to last year, and I just like to share some numbers to show why, you know, I just recently said that I think a reset would be appropriate, and these are my numbers to justify that thought. In the year 2000, the average sales price was $175,400. Now,
that's all over Clark County.
This is Clark County.
From the top of Prune Hill to the bottom of Phillida, or
no, not Phillida, but what is it? Fruit Valley.
Fruit Valley. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. From Prune Hill to the Fruit Valley, and all locations in between, and so then in the year 2008, the average price was $278,300, and that's when the market downturn began, was 2007, 2008. But in 2007, it was $305,500. So it took...
So about a $50,000 hit to the price. Yeah.
Right. So, but then it bottomed out in 2011 with the an average price point of $212,100. So that's going from $305,000 to $212,000. That's a huge.
That's almost a third.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so if you fast forward to the year 2016, the average sales price was, we had rebounded to $328,600 in Clark County. And so that's a $116,000 increase in the market. And so then you jump forward to 2020, then the average sales price was $448,000. So, and just that 5 month period, we've appreciated $120,000. So, but if you look at it as a whole, this is why I think real estate is a great investment. You buy low, sell high, buy early.
Sell high and buy low.
Yeah. And so, but if you had bought a home, well, and I bought, my wife and I bought the home that we're in now in 2003. The average sales price in 2003 was $196,700. And so again, the average sales price for last year was $448,000. So we realized that, now believe me when I tell you that our house is not worth $448,000.
Well, it's worth what somebody might pay for it.
Right.
Not what you, there's a difference between worth and value.
Right, exactly. And so, but we bought it, when we bought our house, we bought it for $155,000.
Yes.
We just took out we refinanced at a lower rate, took out some equity, made some improvement to our homes.
Yes.
So, but it's $310,000. So we doubled our money.
Right. Staggering, but yeah. At the same time, you can't sell it,
right?
Because then you have to find somewhere else to live,
right? Exactly.
Also inflated, so you might as well just hang out there and improve it.
And you know, that's a great point, because that's what a lot of people are doing. Back in the 2000s, the early 2000s, the average length of time a homeowner was staying in their home was like 3.5 years or 4 years.
I know, it was very short,
like that.
Very short.
But now it's almost 15 years.
Yes.
And so, especially now, going back to COVID. Because people have decided to stay in their home a lot longer, they're taking some of that equity, making improvements, increasing the valuation of the home, and making it more along the line of what they're looking for in a home. So it's like, well, we finally got the home that we want. Why are we going to leave?
My wife and I, Shannon, we have a construction project in March for a new deck and solar. So that's exactly right.
So why would you sell your home? You're getting the deck that I'm sure you and your wife has discussed over the years.
No. We're getting the deck Shannon wants.
Happy wife,
happy
life.
Exactly, right.
I heard happy spouse, happy house, but it doesn't carry the same weight as happy wife, happy life.
And that's very true.
Me and my wife, we just put a bunch of money into getting my wife the kitchen that she wants.
We've done that also.
Yeah. I got to pick out the sink.
Life is fabulous after that.
I got to pick out the sink. That's it.
That's
the flooring, nope.
That's more than I got, so you're doing great.
Well, I had to put my foot down. I beat my chest and say, "Hear me roar, woman." And she just looked at me and said, "No." I said, "Well, can I pick out a sink?" Because I do the dishes.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's why I got to pick out the sink. I do the dishes and like I do the dishes, put them in the dishwasher. My wife puts them away.
You can tell a craftsman by his tools.
Yeah, exactly. Or his dishpan hands.
You're a good man.
But yeah, so you know, a lot of people are staying in their homes a lot longer, making improvements. You know, taking the equity, which is, I think, is another great thing with owning real estate, because there's not too many. If you buy stocks, for example, or commodities or whatever, and you want, let's say, $450,000, because last year's average price was $448,000. Let's round up 2,000 to $450,000. If you want to buy $450,000 in stocks, you have to come up with that cash right now, or the some sort of payment in full.
You're right. You could do it on margin, but then your risk goes up astronomically.
Yeah, I'm not going to margin.
Right.
Happy life, stocks. Happy life.
Right.
No.
But you're basically buying a house on margin, but you're not necessarily increasing your risk.
Right, exactly. So, but over time, you know, the value of your home increases, hopefully.
Yes.
You can make improvements to improve the equity position of your home. If you have the old aluminum window frames, for example, you can put in new vinyl windows and that improved the value of your home. A garage door is gives you the greatest returns.
Really?
It gives you 118% of your cost.
An electric garage door, basically. Yeah. Well, we know kitchens are a sink. You know, it does not necessarily improve the value of the house, but it certainly improves the value of the homeowner.
Right, and it improves the livability.
Yes.
And so, but
not necessarily the resale value.
Right. Well, that's one of the biggest drainers, because a new kitchen, I won't even begin to tell you how much we put into our kitchen, but we can't realize that return, and a dollar for dollar average.
Right.
Because like the average kitchen, according to the North American Industrial Home Builders or something like that, the average cost for a new kitchen is close to $40,000. But its realized value on resale is only $30,000.
Yes. But quality of life, happiness of the occupants, you know, quality of your marriage, all are dramatically improved.
And I got to pick out a sink.
And you got the sink of your dreams.
Let that sink in. So, but yeah, it's a great investment vehicle. And again, you know, early on in our conversation, I stated that residential real estate is 1 to 4 units. So imagine if you're young and single and you have some funds, or even a young married couple, you purchase a fourplex or a quad. You live in one, you rent out the other three. In order for you to purchase that, you can do one of two ways, essentially. You can qualify for that purchase on your own, or you can qualify by taking into consideration the rental income that you could receive.
Yeah.
And so you can use it to make money as it appreciates in value, and you make improvements to increase the value. Or if you have a single family home, you can do what is called a ADU, auxiliary dwelling unit. So that's where you rent out a room, or you convert a garage, an attached garage, into a separate unit and make that a livable space. Then you rent that out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So there's many, many different ways that you can become an investor, a real estate investor, and that's on top of the realized appreciation. So it's a pretty cool industry.
So Michael, you've given us some tremendous information, some really, really great stuff today. Tell us how people can get a hold of you and where you're at on the web and all that stuff.
Yeah, my cell phone number is 360-609-1775. My email address is harding.realtor@gmail.com. Pretty generic and boring. And my website, I just recently changed it. It's, just call me. I don't remember. I just changed it, so just give me a call, please.
I'll find it and put it on.
Find it and put it on, because I just changed it. I added a dash somewhere in there.
There you go.
mharding-kw.com or something like that.
Modern technology. Yeah. I'll find it and put it up.
So it's kind of like keeping track of passwords.
That's
keeping
right.
Track of your website.
and thank you. I'm Bill Roller, Beacon Rock Wealth Advisors. That's beaconrwa.com, and we're available there, and billroller@beaconrwa.com.
What about a number?
Well, main number, 360-735-1900. Call that number, and if I'm not there, it'll even go to my cell phone. Miracle of modern technology.
Yeah, isn't it great?
So thanks a lot.
Thank you.